Wild Thing, a song you are all familiar with. It was originally performed by the Wild Ones in 1965 and popularized by the Troggs in 1966. Welcome to the program, everyone. This is Connecting the Notes, and I'm your host, Matthew Ray. And joining us on the show is Chip Taylor, who wrote Wild Thing, as well as the popular songs Angel in the Morning and Try Just a Little Bit Harder. His songs have been recorded by Emmylou Harris, Willie Nelson, Barbara Lewis, Janis Joplin, Dusty Springfield, and Billy Vera, just to name a few. Taylor also cut several solo albums in the 70s before taking a break from music and becoming a professional gambler. He returned to music in 1996 and has a new album out right now, which takes a look back at his life and hometown. It's called Yonkers, New York, and we started our conversation talking about how the idea for the album came about. What was the concept there of doing the...
No, it wasn't. I was actually in the middle of finishing an album, tentatively titled The Rhinebeck Sessions, because I recorded it in Rhinebeck, New York, and I was at the tail end of mixing the album when one day, all of a sudden, Charcoal Sky appeared when I picked up the guitar and I started to drift back to my dad taking us to a train station on his day off on a Monday, and you know, with my brothers and my mom, and I love floating back in that period of time. And the next day, I wasn't thinking about it, but I was starting to go back to the Rhinebeck sessions, and all of a sudden, another one came up, and then I had fun. I think it was Barry Go On, where I found myself back to thinking about when my brother Barry, and I ran away from home, you know, as little kids, just to go for a ride in the train. That's what he wanted to do anyway, and so that's how it started. And then all of a sudden, I was putting down my work on the Rhinebeck sessions and letting myself drift off into the Yonkers territory. And before you know it, I had an album's worth of songs, and I said, let me get in there, and instead of continuing to work on the Rhinebeck sessions, let me document this, because it felt real comfortable, and I wanted to do it.
Yeah, you actually alluded to one of my favorites on that album. It's Charcoal Sky.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can you give us a little background on that song?
Sure. Well, in the final analysis of it, the background on how the song evolved, again, is I'm a stream of consciousness writer, and I wasn't thinking much about it. But when I look at it now in its final stages, I love thinking about it. Monday was a special day for the Voigt family, because it was my dad's day off. He was a golf professional, a working golf professional. You know, back in those days, Matthew, it wasn't like a real elite job. He was a servant to the members, got their clubs, cleaned them, and tried to make them feel good on weekends, and gave them lessons when they needed it and stuff like that. But he was almost like the locker room attendant, real servant to the members. But that being said, he loved his job, and he was a poor kid, and that was the way he supported his family, and it was wonderful. And we loved the fact that that was his job. But the good day for Dad was Mondays, because that was his day off, and his kids went to school on that day, and he wasn't very happy with that. So at one point, he called the principal up and told him that Monday was a Czechoslovakian holy day, and the boys needed to have the day off and get out early from school, which we did. We got out at 12:30 instead of 3 o'clock, and would visit the train stations. We'd go to a couple of double feature movies in Getty Square and Yonkers. But before we would do that, we'd go down to the train station, Neprehan's train station, and see the trains coming in and talk to the conductors. They'd like to talk to the conductors. So I have vivid, wonderful memories of that train station, and I loved the lyrics in it. Just reflect them. Dad's talking to the conductors and the things he would say, and watching a conductor run to the train as it left. I can just picture it now as I'm talking to you. And running to the train to hop on the train, and just after he finished talking to us, I was afraid he'd miss the train, because the train was pulling out of the station. He was still talking to us, but he'd always get about 50 yards down there and hop on board and wave goodbye to us like it was just that he was like the beautiful ballet dancer or something. It was beautiful. Beautiful picture in my mind.
Got a reservation down at Nepperhan Station. Flatten your nickels, boys, and wave that train goodbye. It'll be on time. It's the Hudson River line. God bless America in that charcoal sky. Boys, this is Harry. He's a conductor for the Putnam DeVere. Now, he's been doing it for 18 years. He's been my friend for 9. Harry, this is Barry. Middle son John, little Jamie. Trying to teach my boys about that charcoal sky. Got a reservation down at Nepperhan Station. Flatten your nickels, boys, and wave that train goodbye. It'll be on time. It's the Hudson River line. God bless America in that charcoal sky. Now, since the 1860s, boys, we've been pushing up steam. And I still hear those wheels every time I close my eyes. And without that steam, boys, there'd be no American dream. And Daddy said, God bless you, Harry. We'll see you by and by. Got a reservation down at Nepperhan Station. Flatten your nickels, boys, and wave that train goodbye. It'll be on time. It's the Hudson River line. God bless America in that charcoal sky. Wave goodbye to Harry, boys. The caboose, she's rolling. See him running to catch up to her, and don't he catch it every time. Now, when he hops on board, boys, give a wave. Time we started going. Sooner around that bend, we'll see that charcoal sky. Got a reservation down at Nepperhan Station. Flatten your nickels, boy, and wave that train goodbye. It'll be on time. It's the Hudson River line. God bless America and that charcoal sky. Another song unlocking some family secrets. We're going to take you back a ways. There was a ukulele waiting under my 7th Christmas tree. Until then I was a fiddler, but my brothers had enough of me. They said, oh mommy, oh, Daddy, you could stop that screeching. It would sure make us happy. Merry Christmas. Astor Brothers. And from the ukulele to the guitar in my country high school band, we were signed by an old black record label, just white boys pissing in the wind. I said, oh, mommy, oh, daddy, can't sell no records, but I sure am happy in the business. Merry Christmas. So I signed me a contract to write songs for others and find me a way to get back at my brothers. If it wasn't for those slimy, sneaky mother jumpers, could have been a train man, could have been a trucker. Put me on an oil rig back in Calcutta, like Gitzhard Perlman and Carnegie Hall. I could have had it all if it wasn't for my bastard brothers. Stay on the one, boys. All right, this is a true story. Am I? On my mother's deathbed, my mom, Barbara, called my brothers into the room, Barry and John. Said, there's one thing is my biggest regret in life, boys, and that's taking the fiddle away from your brother. And you boys were responsible. You instigated that, and he could have been a virtuoso, and I always regretted that. And my brothers came out of the room and I said, what's wrong, boys? And they'll tell you later. They told me later. I loved it. What a nice story. Thank you, Mom. La-dee-da, ba-dee-da-da, la-da-dee-da. Oh, until then I was a fiddler, but my brothers were enough of me. They said, oh, mommy, oh, daddy, you could stop that screeching and sure make us happy. Merry Christmas, boys, bastard brothers. So I signed me a contract to write songs for others and find me a way to get back at my brothers. If it wasn't for those slimy, sneaky mother jumpers, I could have been a train man, could have been a trucker. Put me on an oil rig back in Calcutta, like Itzhak Perlman and Carnegie Hall. I could have had it all if it wasn't for my bastard brothers. Merry Christmas, boys.
Chip Taylor with the song Bastard Brothers. Those bastard brothers he refers to in the song are actor John Voight and geologist Barry Voight. Chip was actually born James Wesley Voight and uses Chip Taylor as a stage name. The song references the first label to sign him. He was still a teenager when his country rock high school band got signed with the then all-black label King Records. Here he is talking about how he got his surprising start in music. There's also another one I really liked was Bastard Brothers, where you talk about how you got your start in music.
Yeah.
And you make an allude to the first record deal you got, which was with was it King Records?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And how did you land that? Because you were young at the time, and it's a different type of label than country.
Yeah, it was all Black Division in New York, King Records at that period of time. And the deal was is that, and this is a good lesson for other people. We made demo records. We had this rockabilly group called the Town and Country Brothers, and we made demos, and I wrote the songs for the group, and I was the singer, and there was a guitar player and a drummer, and that we didn't even have a bass player, but we played Irish bars in Mount Vernon in Westchester County someplace when I was 15 years old. They let you do that. We passed the hat and stuff like that. I used to sing country songs. I loved it, even though there was no country music to listen to in New York. I heard it from Wheeling, West Virginia late at night and got to love this stuff. So that's what we did. We made these demos, and they were little rockabilly demos, and sent them to typical fashion to record labels and got typical answers, thanks but no thanks, form letters back. But here's the lesson to be learned. My guitar player, the guitar player in the band, Greg Guardiak, a wonderful fellow, he had such passion for these demos that he just went down to the city and walked door to door and tried to get people to listen to him. And Henry Glover, the guy that heralded, wonderful A&R fellow, the guy that signed Hank Ballard and the Midnighters and James Brown, he invited Greg in and listened to the demos and said, this is exactly what I've been looking for. and called me up that afternoon and said, well, son, you got to deal with King Records. And I was, you know, and if it wasn't for Greg walking the streets, we would never have that deal. So a lot of people, when you get no for an answer, particularly if it's a typical no, you know, like from a form letter or something like that, my advice to folks is never to take no for an answer, and particularly if it comes in that kind of form.
That's good. I can get behind that. did you ever release anything on King?
Yeah, I had several singles released on King. And what happened was is when it finally came time to the sessions, we were going to record as a band, but then when and Henry Glover had loved the sound of our band, but when it came time to record, the Sid Nathan, the head of the company, had decided I might be his great white hope, and so he asked Henry to spare no expense with me, and they hired the best musicians they could find, including Mickey Guitar Baker,
the
amazing guitar player, and Panama Francis were on our session. So we had great musicians, but the recordings, the playing is beautiful on them. It's just great rock and roll stuff. But my songs weren't very good back then, and I was sounded like a sped up Ricky Nelson. I wasn't much good. The release had made a little noise with a couple of them. Territorial hits or something like that, but nothing enough to make me any money, so I finally had to turn my sights to writing songs for other folks.
All right, so you set your sights on songwriting. Was this something you did as just on your own for a while before you got noticed again?
Well, what happened was is that when I was making the recordings for King, and then when I got off King and I went to Warner Brothers for one record, I went to Warner Brothers right after King, and I had a territorial. I had a record that made actually the national charts at number 80 something called Here I Am, but it still didn't make me enough money to quit everything and go know I could make a living in the music business. But then I had another deal with MGM Records for one single. But at that time, somebody heard one of my songs and brought it down to Nashville, and Willie Nelson heard it and loved it, and Willie recorded it. And then another artist heard one of my songs and record a jazz artist and record this little. I'm a simple folk writer, but he liked the song and he made a recording of that. So all of a sudden, I had a recording by a jazz artist and by Willie Nelson. And so then I said, "Whoa, maybe I should turn my sights in this direction." So then I started writing for other folks. Writing and trying to get my songs published, and my first successes were all country successes. I had things recorded by the Brown family, Eddie Arnold and John Loudermilk, and then Bobby Bear, and later on Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings and folks like that. So my first successes were country successes, and then I started writing some rock and roll things.
He sits at my table and he drinks of my wine. You'd never know he was a kin of mine. He calls me brother, then turns around and he calls me bad news to everyone in town. The fun we used to have gave no warning of our fate, 'cause soon a woman's love turned a brother's love to hate. He sits at my table and he drinks of my wine. just to be near this woman. Of mine, just to be near this woman of
Willie Nelson from the 1960s singing Chip Taylor's He Sits at My Table. Willie Nelson and other Nashville musicians played a big role in the success of Chip Taylor as a songwriter.
We interviewed Chip earlier in the week, and here is more from our conversation.
And when you started getting in, interest from the R&B hits, especially, I find kind of interesting with your country background, and then hearing a lot of these early R&B songs that got picked up, were you writing with that in mind, or were you writing country songs that got interpreted a different way by the musicians and producers that bought them?
No, the songs I were writing, I was a country kind of guy to start with, you know, so most of my songs were either rockabilly or country. And so the successes I was having in the country field were, they would record them very similar to my demos. My demos were wonderful little, you know, country demos, you know, good players, and I did them just the way I liked, and try to make them as much as to sound like the Brown Family or something like that as I could, because I love that kind of music, and I had a good instinct as to what would get recordings to sound that way. So I did these demos when they would be recorded in Nashville. The way people recorded songs in Nashville, they would play your demo, and then if they liked your demo, and that's usually why you got something published, then the publisher would bring the demo to the session, and the musicians would sit around the turntable and listen to the demo and try to copy it and make it, just get the feel from that. So most of the things I had recorded in the country field sounds similar to my demos, and in the rhythm and blues field, because I had the Race Records influence, I was very much involved in, and I loved the Race Records from down south, which were later on called R&B music, and from the South, those records were effectively banned from my part of the woods. They were considered far too sexy or whatever, and they didn't like, a lot of folks wouldn't program them because they were recorded by black artists, and it was a heavy prejudice back then. But I loved that music, and that crept into my writing as well. So I did a hybrid of sorts, kind of like, even though I'm from Yonkers, New York, where no country music is and no black music, no Race Records, I started writing country songs, and then a combination of Race Record country songs, which sounded like I was writing rock and roll from Memphis, or blues, rhythm and blues from Memphis, because I was heavily influenced by that stuff. So that's where Angel of the Morning and Wild Thing and Any Way That You Want Me and those songs came from. They came from the influence of the Race Records combined with my country stuff. So I was just a very simple kind of writer, but I would write blues or country.
Oh, queen, you've got the power. You make everything groovy. Wild thing. Wild thing, I think I love. But I wanna know for sure.
Welcome to the program, everyone. This is Connecting the Notes. Thank you for joining us. We are talking with Chip Taylor this hour, the man responsible for writing Wild Thing, Angel in the Morning, and the song you just heard, 1966's Make Me Belong to You, performed by Barbara Lewis. Here's Chip talking some more about some of his other hit songs. I was kind of wondering about a few songs in particular. One of my favorites is Storybook Children, because I love the message and the kind of just makes me feel good inside. The when did you come up with that song?
That's an interesting one. I'll tell you how that was written. I remember like it was yesterday. I was driving into the city, into New York, and I was coming on the Henry Hudson Parkway, and there was a baseball field, and I think there still is down there, and off to the left as you drive into New York from Westchester, just before the toll gate. It used to be 10 cents. I think it's $1.50 now or something like that. And off to the left, there's a baseball field down there. I remember one day walking, looking down there, and I saw these two little kids walking across the field. And one was black and one was white, a girl and a little boy, and they were holding hands. And all of a sudden, I'm a writer. Again, I'm a stream of consciousness writer that rarely ever thinks of an idea or a title or anything like that. I don't do that, and I particularly don't want to do that. But all of a sudden, I was saying, oh, it's like, you know, it's like story. They're like storybook children. You know, there are no worries. And then all of a sudden, that line just stuck in my brain, and I kept thinking about it. Don't forget that storybook children. They're like, why can't we be like storybook children? And I got to the city, and Billy Vera was there working in the place where I at April Blackwood Music. And Billy was there that morning, and I couldn't wait to get to him. I said, Billy, I said, play that song by Joe Cuba that I love so much that you play. I want to hear the feel of that, and I want to hear the chord changes on that. And, you know, so he played me the Joe Cuba song, To Be With You, I think it was called, Storybook Children doesn't sound anything like it, but I got the feel of that song from that, because I always loved the way Billy, the passion of when Billy sang that song. So I got that passion in my brain, and I locked into a couple of those chord changes, and then I started working on that, and within minutes, Storybook Children was written.
You've got your world, and I've got mine, and it's a shame. Two grown-up worlds that will never be the same.
If only we were storybook children.
Try just a little bit harder. When was that originally written?
That's a funny story. Jeez, that's one I haven't told all that much. But okay, you have to follow this. Every once in a while, I used to write songs with a wonderful writer, Jerry Ragavoy. We didn't write that many things together. We didn't write that many times together, just a few. But we seemed to come up with something every time we did. And we had written I Can't Wait Until I See My Baby's Face for Baby Washington, and Dusty Springfield recorded, and a few other people. And one day we were writing a thing for Garnett Mims. He wanted to write a big ballad for Garnett Mims, and so I was there working with him, and we came up with this thing called Try, and it was this big kind of Otis Redding-ish kind of ballad, and I liked it, and it sounded pretty passionate and pretty cool, and we wrote that afternoon, and I went home, and I didn't think anything of it, and he called me a few days later. He said, "Hey, Chip, that song we wrote for Jerry, I mean for Garnett, you think we can... We think we can change that into an up-tempo song, because Lorraine Ellison's coming up for a session and she needs an up-tempo song on her session." And it was in the evening that he called me, I think. And I the next day, I said, "When do you need it by?" He said, "I need it by tomorrow." I said, I was a little taken back. I was hoping he had more time, because the next day, part of my occupational hazards was that I made bets at the racetrack, and most of the time I had a bookie, but the bookie had just dropped me, and so I needed to go to the racetrack the next day. I knew I had a horse I wanted to bet, and so I needed to be at the racetrack at 1 o'clock. Now Jerry was telling me he wanted the up-tempo version of Try by the next morning, and so what I did is I said, "I'll try to get there by 10 o'clock and give you something." So that night I took another song of mine that had not had success, but it was a very important song to me, and I stole the rhythm and the groove from my own song. It was a song I wrote called On My Word, and I kind of forced and pushed the words to Try just a little bit harder into On My Word, and I came up with an up-tempo version of Try just a little bit harder, and I went down to Jerry's, and I played him the new version, and at around 10 o'clock, and he had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he started playing along with me on the piano with it, and he said, "Yeah, I really like that," and I had put this little chord break for a horn line in it and stuff like that, and he really loved that, and we banged that out, and by around 11:15, I was on the way out to the racetrack, and I remember I had a good day, and the horse I bet won the race, and I was feeling good and written this song and had a winning bet and came home, and Jerry said he was playing it for Lorraine that night. And I just didn't think any more about it. And I didn't talk to Jerry for a long, long time. And sure enough, Lorraine recorded it. And then Janice heard Lorraine's version and recorded it. And I didn't know that Janice had recorded it until one day I was driving down to the city, and I heard it on the radio. Somebody said, "This is a new Janis Joplin single," and all of a sudden, Try came on the radio. I said, "Look at this. You never know."
Just a little bit harder, so I can love, love, love him. I tell myself, well, I'm gonna try, yeah. Just a little bit harder, so I won't lose, lose, lose him to nobody else. Hey, well, I don't care.
bit harder.
Oh, I got to try some more. I said try.
Try.
Janis Joplin with Try Just a Little Bit Harder, a song written by Chip Taylor, the man we are featuring this hour on Connecting the Notes. We interviewed Chip Taylor this week, and here's more from our conversation.
Did you ever take a seat in kind of the producer's chair or go down to some of these sessions to see what they were doing with your stuff?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I did. I produced a bunch of records myself, but in the early days when I was just going down there, yeah, I would be invited down to Nashville when they were recording my songs, and the Jordanaires would be in the studio, and the Nashville A team would be down there playing, and Grady Martin, and actually Hank Garland too, back in the early days, and it was wonderful period of time. And yeah, I would be there, and once in a while I would make a suggestion, and they'd say, well, I remember one producer saying, well, I said, you know, I don't think Grady's playing the rhythm quite right. And he said, Chip, you got one choice. You got two choices. You either keep your mouth shut or you go out there and tell him, because I'm not going to tell him. That's what the producer said. So I went out and I said, well, I'll go talk to Grady. You know, and first of all, I have to understand it was a kind of a funny time back in the 50s, you know, with New Yorkers, you know, the Yankees going back down south. You know, you had to keep quiet down there. You didn't want to say too much and let the Yankee in you out too much. But I went out. I remember when Grady was playing, I went out there and I was just a little kid, and I said, Grady, I think that rhythm could be a little bit different. You know, it's not quite the way I hear it. He said, well, son, why don't you show me, or something, handing me the guitar. And so I picked up the guitar and I played it the way I thought it should be. And he looked at me and he stared at me and he said, you know, I think that's better than what I was doing. I kind of breathed a sigh of relief and walked back outside and back into the studio, and the producer was laughing. He said, well, good work.
I think that's what kind of surprised me when I started going back and listening to your early albums like Gasoline and Chip Taylor's Last Chance and stuff, was that I was expecting this big Nashville sound out of your solo records.
Uh-huh.
And it's not, it doesn't have that Nashville sound. Was that motivated on your part to kind of send your songs on a different avenue, or was it
well,
your personal
taste?
Well,
no, it's just the way I felt them. You know, I felt them more like this. I was more of a, you know, this New Yorker that did this thing. And now, if you listen to those records, there's a wonderful feeling in those records. Mm. And like, there isn't the best of Nashville records. There's good feeling, but they're not. They're more of a my records are more like a band play. They're more like Willie played them later, or Waylon did them later when they weren't entrapped by the, you know, the prepared Nashville sound. You know, so that's the way I looked at Last Chance. Last Chance was an album that was, you know, a real fan. You know, Waylon loved Last Chance, and Johnny Cash really was a fan of Last Chance and stuff like that, because it was an honest country. The real country people would like it, but it wasn't like a caricature of itself like so many of the recordings were.
I was on a bus coming back to us from Atlanta in 53. I picked up a Rhythm and Blues magazine laying underneath my seat, and I found out the stuff they'd been playing us wasn't made from grits and bone, and it'd take more than the crew cuts and Pat Boone to
take me home. I want the real thing. Work with me, Annie.
Give me the real thing all night late.
Make it loud and I'll make you proud of the songs they'd sing.
Annie had a baby.
I want you under my roof with your 86 proof watered down till it tastes like tea. My string, make it the real thing for me. And I remember old Elvis when he forgot to remember to forget. And when young Johnny Cash hadn't seen this side of the Big River yet. And when sun was more than the daylight shining on Memphis, Tennessee. Perkins was picking and playing them songs to me. I want the real thing. Train loves
give me the real thing.
Leaving my heart.
Make it loud
and I'll make you proud of the songs they'd sing.
Everybody's baby but mine.
Don't want you under my roof with your 86 proof watered down till it tastes like tea. Gonna pull my string, make it the real thing for me. And when sun was more than the daylight shining. Perkins was picking and playing them songs for me. I want the real thing.
Train love.
Give me the real thing.
Leaving my heart.
Make it leaving. I'll make you proud of the songs they'd sing.
Everybody's baby but mine.
Don't want you under my roof with your 86 proof watered down till it tastes like tea. Gonna pull my string, make it the real thing for me. You're gonna pull my string, make it the real thing for me.
I Want the Real Thing, written and performed by Chip Taylor in 1973. In addition to writing all the songs we've been talking about this hour, Chip also released 6 solo records before leaving music for over a decade, during which time he lived as a professional gambler. One might assume a songwriter leaves the business out of financial necessity, but that was not the case with Taylor, and he shared some striking insight on the business of songwriting. So did you, I'm always trying to kind of wrap my head around that songwriters, and once you wrote a song, was it no longer yours, and did you get kind of screwed by royalties, or did you?
No, like, not me.
No, you, yeah, you're the one, you're a rare story, actually. Like, most of these are kind of down and out stories.
Well, you know, I don't want to demean or diminish the stories you might hear too much, but I want to diminish them somewhat. First of all, with me, I'm an example of how well my songs were taken care of. You know, I was one of the first staff writers to April Blackwood Music, which was CBS's new publishing company. And those deals were lock solid deals, and they always treated me good, and my songs were, and April Blackwood was then bought by Sony, and then Sony sold it to another group of people, and the other group of people sold it to EMI. So the April Blackwood songs that I wrote and all the stuff from April Blackwood at that time, a lot of great songs from April Blackwood, ended up with EMI, which treats music unbelievably well and treats writers always very, very fairly, and I always was treated fairly. That being said, what stories you hear often are a writer will say, well, I sold half of my song for a dinner or a drink or a whatever, you know, I don't know what they sell. Well, the truth of the matter is all writers back in those days sold half of their song for whatever they sold it for. I used to get $30 in advance against royalties from the first songs I wrote. And that was what the deal was. You sold half of your songs. You owned half, and the publisher owned half. And the publisher, if he was a good publisher, he earned his 50% by going out and helping you get somebody to record your song. So if a writer now is telling you that they sold half of their song back then for whatever, you know, and isn't that too bad? Well, probably it isn't too bad, because if the song means anything at all now, somebody who handled that song probably did a damn good job. And so they probably, if they sold half, that was what the deals were back then. You gave up half for somebody to do a good job exploiting your song. So oftentimes those stories are misconstrued a little bit, and I'm sure there are some very bad stories with writers who didn't deal with straightforward companies and kind of got messed up. I was very fortunate. The company that I dealt with then and that I deal with now with all my big hits, BMI is the company that now owns those things in conjunction with me. They always treated me really fairly.
Well, there's rights and wrongs and fighting songs on both sides, and each day finds me changing points of view. And one says you got to hurt to know the feeling, and another's fighting feelings to get through. And I'm tired of hearing that same old story about where you gotta stand to feel your pain. These days it's hard to find a hero to help us helpless fools out of the rain. And my daddy was a golf pro up in Scarsdale, and he worked his tail off 6 days a week. He can't plant no taters with your golf club, but them city boys would listen when he'd speak. And I'm tired of hearing that same old story about where you gotta stand to feel your pain. And there's a truck stop on the wrong side of glory, and it's filled with fools waiting for a train. Get it, Joe? And I heard some cowboy singing about his Indians, pre-war, free-boar, pre-faded jeans, like he thinks there's a chance we wouldn't win again if the whole world understood the song he sings. And I am tired of hearing that same old story about where you gotta stand to feel your pain. And I listened, but he never did assure me that he wasn't selling wholesale turquoise rings. Now the troops have all withdrawn from Southeast Asia, and the Swiss bank's got the bullion left by two, and we've rescued every blessed soul for saving, and we'll adopt the ones that look like me and you. And I'm tired of hearing that same old story, and I wonder if I'll always feel the pain. God bless the ones that don't do so much for those that do. God damn the ones that keep this world insane.
Chip Taylor with Same Old Story from his 1975 effort, This Side of Big River. 4 years after that release, Chip would leave music for nearly 16 years. Here he is talking about that period of time. Is the affinity towards gambling, was that the main reason you stepped back from music for a period of time there?
Well, yeah, it was kind of the battles I was having with the record companies, and gambling was becoming more and more a part of my life all the time. So I think the battles had a lot to do with it, and I was getting worn down by that. And I was I loved gambling. I mean, I was good at it, and I was a card counter at blackjack, and I was finally. And when I gave up music entirely for a couple of years, they let me play at all the casinos without bothering me, and I did fine. But then all of a sudden they started to crack down on what they started to get word that there were card counters out there that were doing okay. And so in the early 80s, they banned all the card counters and from Atlantic City casinos. Or then there was maybe 10 or 15 of them, and I was one of them. And so that stopped me from doing that. Finally, the Supreme Court said they couldn't ban me anymore, but they, when I went back to the casinos, they would just follow me around, and if I made a big bet, they'd shuffle the cards. So that's, to all extents and purposes, took away any advantage I might have had. So I went to the other thing I was good at, which was horse race handicapping, and I did that professionally for many, many years. Well, I was doing it professionally when I was Wild Thing and Angel of the Morning. I was making lots of money as betting horses, but finally I just did that full time, and I teamed up with the biggest money maker of all time, Ernest Dahlman, D-A-H-L-M-A-N, for anybody who wants to look it up. He's a wonderful family man and a great scientist handicapper, and we teamed up, and he's the biggest money maker there ever was at the game. And had wonderful years with Ernie. And so that was it. That's my life. And I had to give all that up when I decided to come back. I said, for the first time, I got to be free and clear of all this. If I want to get back in the music business, when I started Trainwreck Records, I said, boy, I got to give up the other thing. Otherwise, I'll be doing it halfway, and it will never work. And so I called up Ernie and said, you're not going to believe this, Ernie. I said, but for the time being, for the foreseeable future, I am giving up gambling. And I just totally gave it up cold turkey and just concentrated on music and found a way to have my record label and distribution and touring. And for the first time in my life, I was touring in Holland and England and Sweden and loving every minute. And it's been great ever since.
Chip Taylor has been releasing a lot of music since his return in 1996 and has also founded his own record company, Trainwreck Records. We're going to end the show with arguably Chip's biggest hit besides Wild Thing. This song is called Angel of the Morning and was composed in 1967. It's been recorded by a number of artists, including Merrily Rush and the Turnabouts, Juice Newton, Nina Simone, P.P. Arnold, and Evie Sands, who was actually the first to record the song. We're going to listen to the Merrily Rush and Turnabouts in their 1968 rendition. Thank you all for tuning in. If you'd like more information on Chip Taylor, visit trainwreckrecords.com. And if you'd like to learn more about the show, connectingthenotes.com will fill you in sufficiently. So, Merrily Rush and Turnabouts with Angel in the Morning.
Just call me Angel of the Morning, Angel. Light will be dim, and it won't matter anyhow. If morning's echo says we've sinned, well, it was what I wanted now. And if we're victims of the night, I won't be blinded by the light. Just call me Angel of the Morning, Angel.